Thanks for downloading this podcast. It's for personal use only and must not be broadcast, reproduced, or used in any form without permission.
Tell your friends they can get their own copy wherever they get their podcasts.
Hello and welcome to this, the 2022 Formula One season preview here on the Radio Show Limited network of channels. I'm Tim Gray and I'll be taking you through the next 75 minutes where we'll be hearing from our Formula One expert, Nick Damon.
Hooray!
So let's start by taking a look at the calendar for this year's Formula One season. And
yes,
we were told we were going to have our biggest season ever with 23 races, and already that's down to 22. And this time, COVID is not the culprit.
No, it's rather... I don't know. What's the most serious thing? A global pandemic or the potential of World War III? Because that's the difference. That's what's taken it out, obviously, from this year, with the Russian Grand Prix being cancelled forever. Yes, we don't have the Russian Grand Prix. There are a number of potential replacements. Initially, Turkey was the one mooted as being the most likely. Now it appears that Qatar could be in with a chance again. So remains
to be
seen.
I've heard lots of talk about Sepang as well coming back.
Yeah, Sepang's interesting. Yeah, Sepang, I think they're looking at logistics, aren't they? Because it's just trying to find the...
Well, it was in between Italy and Singapore.
Yeah, and they're going to Singapore. So, yes, Italy, Turkey, Singapore isn't that bad, but it is the week after. So, so Malaysia make a lot of sense, because I think Malaysia and Singapore, the two tracks are only about 100 miles apart, actually. They're remarkably close.
No China again this year?
Nope. Despite having Guangzhou in the grid, they won't be. It was too difficult to guarantee the arrangement. That was COVID rules, but of course, with the announcement that the Imola Grand Prix, I can't remember what it's called, the Emilia Romagna Grand Prix, have made in Italy TM, has been renewed for 3 or 4 years, they had to shuffle somebody else out. And of course, we don't have Qatar this year. We are getting Qatar back next year. They aren't in this year at the moment because they're hosting the World Cup. So, you know, it's a full calendar. They want to get Las Vegas in as well. So somebody's going to drop off. And my first bet would have been the Imola race. So somebody else is looking a little bit wobbly. Though, of course, they did up the number of races they're allowed to have, the 24, didn't they? So they could add another one.
Yes, and of course, the organisers of the Emilia-Romagna Grand Prix clearly thought the same thing. Thought we'd better get in there and get a contract signed before anyone realises. One addition that is new to this year's calendar is the Miami Grand Prix. That's going to be round 5 of the championship on the 8th of May.
Yes, it is, and very exciting it is too. I mean, obviously they have less Russian yachts to be there, but they'll have enough money from other dodgy sources to fill all the grandstands. Yeah, going around the Hard Rock Cafe and the hotel and the Miami Stadium. It's it realistically, I have no idea. It could be a fantastic circuit, or it could be another disastrous car park nightmare. My guess is it'll probably be nearer the former, but whether it how it looks, how it races, I've no idea. But it's always nice to go somewhere new.
And the season actually ends, despite the extra races, ends slightly earlier than it has done in the last couple of years, with the final race on the 20th of November.
Yeah, it was very, very late last year. It was about the 11th or 12th of December. It just got a bit too long. So they have condensed a very big season into a short amount of time, so a lot less time off for the teams. Of course, they have pretended, they've got this pretense they're all getting a day less, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because they've removed all the official parts of Thursday. So Thursday used to have scrutineering, some official press engagements, and now they've removed all of that. Both the Friday practices have moved later, so they're not now morning and afternoon, they're sort of lunchtime and late afternoon. Of course, if it's one of the sprint weekends, it's lunchtime and then qualifying late afternoon. So they've effectively tried to claim they've got a day back. I'm not sure if they have, but that's the idea that they can now. They've cleared up 23 days to throw in more races. It is a very, very, very difficult schedule, and let's be honest about this, Tim. It's not for the drivers. It's not for the Toto Wolffs, the Christian Horners. The real, real difficulty is for the guys who are actually, you know, mechanicking the cars or driving the trucks or doing, yeah, who aren't in the glamour roles but are working very, very hard on days outside of race days. And that's a very, very difficult schedule, even for a single young man. If you're, you know, if you're with a family, you know, you begin to think, or perhaps they should run two teams. But one of the problems of running at two teams is the cost cap. You haven't got the money to do it. So, you know, there'll be a lot of very tired people by the 20th of November.
Now, you mentioned the sprint there, and there are some changes to the sprint this year. But let's first look at which three events will hold the sprint. And they are the Grand Prix of Emilia-Romagna, the Austrian Grand Prix, and the Sao Paulo Grand Prix.
I didn't think you drove the sprint enough then. It's sprint. The sprint. You know, I kind of think the sprint should become our new Sebastian Loeb, to be honest. Even though he's not in it, which is not the only event he hasn't done. Obviously the Emilia-Romagna Grand Prix, which is just all the talk of the town at the moment. The big change obviously is it's 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So there's a lot more points available. They wanted to have 6. The teams managed to blank that off on cost grounds, so we want more money if we're going to do that. Actually, they wanted more money and more cost caps. They wanted more money from F1 generally, and also be allowed to up the cost cap, and that was pushed away. So we went back to 3 of last year. Imola, yeah, we're looking at the new cars. Everyone's saying the new cars may be easy to pass, but Imola's not an easy track to pass on, so I'm not sure why they've chosen that one. In fairness, we already got reasonable races in Austria, so with easier passing, it should be better. And, of course, the Brazilian sprint race was quite spectacular last year because Lewis had to come from the back. So, yeah, I mean, I think I wouldn't have chosen Imola. I'd have chosen somewhere else that's a bit more exciting. But, you know, 2 out of 3 ain't bad, as Meatloaf used to say.
And we're getting an extra 5 inches, aren't we, this year?
Are we? Okay. Well,
that's 13 centimetres if you're young and use metric terms.
I have no idea. Oh, are you talking about wheel diameter?
Wheel diameter, yes. Oh, what else are we talking about?
I know. Honestly, my brain went through, are they making the gaps between the grids a bit longer? You know, that sort of thing. But no, yes, they've gone from 13 inches to 18 inches. Who are misses, but with the shortening of the reducing the sidewalls, the actual overall increase in tire diameter, I think it's only 6 centimeters. They're not a lot bigger, but of course it's a lot more wheel and a lot less rubber. Lot of knock-ons for that. One, they're a lot heavier, which is one of the reasons for the massive increase in weight this year of I think 45 kilos. Before they added even more to it, and of course it completely changes the way suspension's done because. Yeah, the cars used to have a lot of flexibility in the sidewalls, which was worked into the way the suspension worked. Now they've got very rigid sidewalls, and you have to completely redesign the suspension. So, you know, a lot of work being done there. So it's many years overdue aesthetically, and of course, because no one's been. You can't buy a road car with 13-inch wheels and haven't been able to for about 6 years.
I haven't seen them for a very long time.
Inches, yeah, I mean, it's even like your basic, shopping trolley car is on 15 inches. So
is this road car technology influencing Formula One then?
Yeah, it's the way it goes. Let's go, if you think about it, you know, we've had that sort of size tyres in sports cars for a long time. So it's a very tried
Formula
and trusted
Formula 2 as well.
Yeah, it's a tried and trusted formula. They've limited a little bit the brake, increasing rotation brake size, because that would be a major, major performance enhancer, but obviously they've mandated some parts around the front end again. So, yeah, I mean, we've now seen them, and I think they look really good. I really like them. I like the tyres. I like the wheel covers. Not overly sure. I think it was Red Bull who are using like red edging on their wheel covers, which confused everybody. We were trying to work out what compound they've got on. But, apart from that, they look pretty good.
Pirelli, of course, the official tyre supplier. We now have a standard rim supplier as well. That's BBS. And This year, for the first time, a standard tyre warmer blanket supplier. So every team has to use the same tyre warming blankets.
Well, you skipped over the wheel, but there was quite a lot of work on wheel design in the past 2 or 3 years. Mercedes came up with a very innovative rear wheel. The years all blend together, maybe in 3 or 4 years, which helped solve some of their overheating issues. And eventually the concept was copied by a couple of other teams as well. Blanket temperatures come down as well. So the tyres come out of the blanket slightly cooler. They didn't. I think I'm not sure. Was it when these were originally mooted, or was it mooted for a couple of years' time? They were talking about having no warmers at all. But they
wanted no tie warmers at all.
Yeah, they've rowed back from that. For safety reasons.
That's not going to happen until 2024 now.
I think that may never happen.
They have to have these standard ones. They can't make their own.
Yeah, I think that's because they want to make sure they are, you know, if they say 80 degrees, it is 80 degrees. It's part of the policing. So, yeah, I mean, that's quite a good idea for spandex parts. There's no point reinventing that particular wheel. And, you know, I think Pirelli also probably didn't want to try and build a tire that could work at 0 degrees. So it helps them as well. I'm saying it now, in March 2022, I don't believe that no tire warmer rule will come in.
We shall wait and see. There's another tyre related change, and that's about which tyres you start the race with, isn't there, Nick?
Yeah, this is a really interesting one. I read this and I thought, it's a bit of a backward step. Historically, the tyres in which you qualified with the top 10 drivers who got into qualifying three, whatever tyres, and that's the exact set of tyres you set your fastest time in qualifying two, with the tyres you set your tyres you started the race on. So what we tended to see was, do you go for the softest tyre to get into Q3, or, you know, do you go for a better race tyre? Now, what happened was, due to the stretching of the grids towards the back end of the most recent rules, Mercedes and more often than not Red Bull could actually get through on the harder tyre anyway, regardless, because they're basically quicker, which kind of took away the tactical advantage of running on that normally the medium tyre rather than the soft. Now, with the now much more theoretically condensed field, it's kind of weird they've moved away from that, and they've taken away that element of randomness or even team tactics, because they basically everyone will qualify the whole way through on softs, and you can start on whatever tyre you want. You have a medium and a hard in your allocation, so almost say let's do it one stop with medium and hard, and yes, you have enough sets to qualify through on the soft, so it's a little bit less dramatic, I think, but not, I think it's a retrograde step. I'm not quite sure why they've done it. It doesn't seem to save money. It doesn't seem to save anything in the tactics. It's based kind of on old information that the top teams were good enough to qualify through on a harder tyre, which may well not be true this year.
So there's a few other standardised systems this year as well, Nick.
Yeah, it is a much more prescriptive set of regulations. The rear wing is pretty standardised, though people are finding, you know, way slightly different things, the angles, the shapes of it. There's a number of standardised parts in the braking system. The wheel covers, for example, are standard. Some of the inner discs are standard. So there's a lot all over. I think some of the fuel systems are standard as well. There's an awful lot of more standardised parts. There are obviously the areas where teams are sharing parts. So, for example, the entire rear end of the AlphaTauri is the same as the entire rear end of the Red Bull. And likewise, I think Mercedes and Aston Martin, though I think McLaren have their own rear end, or they actually do because they're on pull rod suspension, aren't they, have their own rear end, but they have a Mercedes engine, so there's mixing and matching around your suppliers, because you are allowed to supply a number of parts as part of the engine package. So that's carried on going. But yeah, I mean, it is a set of regulations, but they're trying to move theoretically for cost, but also I think to cut off areas of development. I mean, this is the idea to try and reduce those more obvious areas of development where they can. And you can argue, is it Formula One? But we seem to have moved past the is it Formula One argument. I've kind of lost that. I've lost my cubic dollars argument now. We're in cost cap world. So they're kind of, you know, just ramming it down the throat. It's all personal about me, you know.
Engines and power units still restricted. They've added another restriction into that category as well, which is that you're only allowed to use 6 exhausts over the course of a season.
Yeah, I think it was 8 last year, wasn't it? They've kind of reduced that. I think it hasn't normally been a problem. I think Alpine had a problem last year. They were burning out their exhaust quite early. There's not a lot of performance game. I think that's trying to prevent people making it a disposable item for a very small gain. Engines, of course, the big thing there is they've changed the fuel from a 5.5% general biomass to actually 10% ethanol, and that provides a lot of tuning issues. Ethanol doesn't produce as much power for any given amount of fuel. It burns in a different way, but it does. But it's less inclined to detonation, so there are upsides. But on the whole, it's about trying to make the engines run as well and only lose as little power as possible from the effectively, I think it's a theoretical loss of about 3.5%, I think, of horsepower by running that much ethanol in the car. So, yeah, over the 5% before. So it's good. And then there's a lot of engineering, but you've had lots of words from all the, oh, it's a nightmare sorting out. Oh, it's terrible. The most change you ever had to make. But, you know, always good to talk out the work you've been doing in your engines. So yes, and of course we've got a new Renault engine that's I think on split turbo, and I think there's a new Ferrari. So now all four engines are pretty much brand new. You see the Mercedes are reworking, a major reworking. So they're all starting from a level playing field, and the idea is that playing field will stay level because they are effectively homologated forever, apart from I say forever till 2026, apart from of course changes for reliability, which should normally effectively upgrade, certainly how Renault used to carry things out during the V8 era anyway.
And of course thanks to the FIA's working group, there are absolutely no loopholes or vagaries in these regulations.
No.
So all the cars are going to be legal from the outset, and no one can possibly protest against anything. Yes,
that's right, because they all look the same and they're all the same, and everything's lovely, and no one's going to have any rows about anything apart from the protests we were already expecting on Friday.
Yes. Surely the working group would have spotted that early.
Well, I'm afraid they're arguing about the spirit of the rules, and that's always a bad way to go. I think the thing that has the most ire at the moment, though it may well change by tomorrow, are the Mercedes wing mirrors, because they're not in the spirit of the rules, but you know,
their mirrors and their wings. Wing mirrors.
They are, exactly, yes. And it's the wing bit that's annoying people. But yeah, I mean, there's going to be constant rowing. You know, we had the whole Christian Horner saga, didn't we, during the Bahrain test, where he decided the Mercedes was illegal before he'd seen it. And then said he hadn't made the quote, then had to admit he had made the quote, and then had to admit it was legal. So it's good to know he's starting as toxic this year as he ended last year, but hey-ho.
On the subject of Christian Horner.
Really?
And things he said. We have a new race director.
Well, yes, only because Lewis moaned. It's the only reason we have a new race directors we have.
Yes, two of them. One we know very well, and one we know less well.
Yeah, Eduardo Freitas. I know him so less well, I can't remember his name. The guy from DTM, I'll call him.
Niels Wittig, yes.
Thank you, Niels Wittig. And Eduardo from
the World Endurance Championship.
And LMS. Yeah, I mean, the fact is, regarding Michael Massey, the revisionism by Horner has once again been Horner-esque. Frankly, I think Christian Horner just embodies all the worst parts of the slimiest politician you can imagine. And his constant reinventing and trying to turn things around and spin is just so irritating. Oh, no, Michael should never have been fired. The fact about it is, it doesn't really matter what Massey did, who it benefited and who it didn't benefit. The fact is, he lost the confidence of the paddock. Now, just because you're Red Bull and you benefited from it, you have to realize it wasn't just Mercedes' confidence he lost. He lost the confidence of most of the teams with those decisions towards the back end of the season. When you've lost the room, or you've lost the dressing room, as is known in with football clubs, the manager goes. And, you know, he hasn't been sacked. He's still got a job. He's still being paid. He'll find another role within the FIA. No one's saying he's useless. He just made enough errors at the back end, you know, of many types for and against everybody. He made enough errors at the end of last season where he lost the confidence. And at that point, the position becomes untenable. So, you know, it's not personal. It's just he's... you know, he's not been good enough at the job. And you can absolutely say he wasn't supported well enough, but the facts remain, he just didn't do the job well enough, and therefore he's not got it anymore. It's like any other job. There's no difference between that and any other job. If you make massive, massive mistakes, at some point you're going to lose your job.
And there's been a change to the safety car procedure.
Has there?
Yes. Or more specifically, when the safety car can return to the pits at the end of the safety car period after cars that have unlapped themselves have been given the instructions to unlap themselves.
That's all the cars, not just some cars.
All the cars, yes.
Yes, all the cars, yeah.
So, So they've rather than waiting until the lap after the last car has unlapped itself from the leader, the safety car will now be withdrawn the lap after the instruction has been given that all the cars may unlap themselves.
That's good. Well done. That's clearing up the writing. That's sorting out. That's speeding things back up again. Well done. You know, it's a little bit horse. You know, a little bit stable door horse. But there we go. That's what often happens in rulemaking.
And we welcome back Herbie Blash.
We do welcome back Herbie. Herbie, who's now going to be effectively an advisor, a sage mind to advise the race directors. He's a lovely guy, Herbie. Been there for many years. I've had many a pleasant conversation, cup of coffee and a drink with Herbie. So, yeah, I'm very pleased to see him back.
Anything else technical that you want to mention? Well, you've also,
don't forget, we've got VAR back as well.
Oh, yes, of course, we have the
the video assistant stewards.
Yes, VAS.
And I'm waiting for the first one of those because it's obviously going to be an absolute nightmare. You know, you can just see it, can't you, in advance. The whole thing's going to go horribly wrong. But, so we see these. I hope they'll all dress in little referees' uniforms. That'd be quite funny. And blow a whistle. No, stop.
They'll surely all wear the white shirt with the FIA logo on that everyone has to wear.
Possibly, yeah.
But without getting to go to the circuit.
Well, that's it. They're doing it remotely. Are they doing it remotely from Biggin Hill, or are they doing it from...
From Biggin Hill, yes.
Oh, right. So I wasn't sure they're going to do like an independent sort of thing, you know, somewhere away they can't be influenced by anybody.
Yes. Like Sam Collins, he'll be in Biggin Hill for a lot of the races.
Yes, that's Sam. He's always bending things to his will, isn't he?
Perfect politician.
At least he is a politician, so it's fine.
Can you think of anything else technical that you need to mention before we go on to our team-by-team section?
Well, obviously the entire technical regulations have changed for the cars, but we're just skipping over that, are we?
We're kind of skipping over that because, you know, it's only the biggest change in four decades.
Yeah, we'll skip that then and just say, yeah, the cars are a bit different and they look a bit different and they've got bigger wheels, bigger tyres. Now we're going back to ground effect and, yeah, they'll probably come out in the team-by-team, to be honest.
Yeah. So team by team,
we start
with last year's champion.
Oh, are we? Oh, okay.
Team, which was Mercedes, they claimed that they're really slow in testing. That Ferrari and Red Bull are well ahead of them, and possibly McLaren as well.
Yeah, they are a little bit the boy who cried wolf, as far as this is concerned. I'm not sure if they cried Toto wolf, I'm not sure.
They've said this before, haven't they, at the start of the season? I think what happened then?
Well, someone said every year apart from 2020, they've said this. So, you know, they have previous form. And what tends to have happened is they've won. They were in pretty big trouble this time last year. They had a terrible test with the car when it was they'd lost the rear downforce because of the... changes the rear deck and just hadn't managed to work out how to get it to work, and the low rate cars got really badly affected, but they managed to work their way around it in time for Bahrain, even though in fairness Red Bull should have won that race and just managed not to win somehow. The car came out in Spain, the first test, with a car that, you know, let's call it a conventional looking car. Nothing's conventional because they're all brand new, but you know what I'm saying, nothing spectacular about it. And they actually managed to pick up the fastest time that wasn't a soft tire. And everyone's going, yeah, they're there or thereabouts. And they did lots of miles. And of course, they turned up at the Bahrain test, and it was a test, with a radical new look to the side pod, supposedly worth a second a lap. And just never really seemed to get on top of it. They did a lot of laps, which is obviously very positive, very good reliability. Constantly lagging, probably in adjusted time, between half and three quarters of a second behind Ferrari. And then obviously with the sudden improvement at Red Bull on the last day again, perhaps three quarter seconds definitely behind Red Bull. But then there was a lot of kind of smoke and mirrors about whether they're actually using full power and they're losing a lot of speed. The car didn't look great on the track. I mean, in fairness, none of the cars look great on the hard tyres on the track. And then certainly you saw a lot of locking up and going and moving on. From my untrained eye, it did seem like what their issues are I would say mostly suspension, Tim. I think that's where their issues are. It's about the actual platform itself. They obviously haven't got any engine issues because it's reliable. We saw how good the engines were in the other three teams as well. The engine is fine. The aero is so much more dependent on how the suspension runs now, because obviously how you handle the car on the track, how you place it on the track, which is how the wheels are attached to the ground and the suspension, affects how you run with the aero. And also you hear about porpoising the whole time, and you know, as the downforce over grips and then stalls the diffuser, and it's about, you know, we've all gone through porpoising. My feeling is that it's you know, they have been the masters of using clever suspension over the last few years. You know, you can say the kings of aero have been Red Bull for 15 years. The kings of suspension have definitely been Mercedes, and those tricks, that box of tricks has been taken away. The Fricks was taken away, and the hydro connection, and now nothing. He's got four independent wheels, and they really have to find a way of working out how to make the car work on its platform with springs and dampers, and I just felt that looking at the car, that was where they weren't there. You know, they were even having to think about losing some downforce to get the suspension to work, to get the platform to work. And the plus point for that is something that they can, I think, with the amount of time they have before the first race and the amount of simulation they can do, they can certainly move that forward. Now, if it ends up being a semi-inherent part of the way the suspension is designed, that's a longer effort. But I think maximizing it is going to be relatively simple. So say they were 3/4 second behind, getting to within 1/4 second, I think is quite possible for them just by maximizing what they've got, working out rake angles and everything else. It's quite interesting. One of the things I was told so long ago when I was still actually in the paddock was that the modern F1 cars, to get the performance, it's 40% engine, 40% aero, and 20% suspension, mechanical grip. I think during the course of the last X number of years, as the engines have converged, that 40% is the same for everybody. And as people's suspensions got cleverer, that's kind of converged. So all the big gains were made in that 40% of aero. I think this year we're going to see a lot of gains being made as people get their hands on the actual uppy downy bits, so the suspension bits, the platform. That's going to be really, really important because they're starting from a reduced scratch with a very, very complex concept running underbody airflow, which produces huge amounts of downforce and sucks the car onto the ground. But it's sucking the car onto the ground. Sometimes at times you don't need it down the straights. And, you know, we only had to look how ponderous the cars were when they're going around slow corners, because they had effectively virtually no downforce because of the reduced wing areas. And that's where you need to get mechanical grip. So I think that the suspension engineers are going to be earning their keep, and nowhere more than at Brackley, where the team certainly is, it's not in desperate trouble, but it's certainly behind at this moment at least two teams.
This is, of course, the F1W13 chassis and the F1 M13 Mercedes-AMG engine that's
doubly unlucky for some,
being run by the Mercedes-AMG Petronas F1 team. And two drivers who are not unfamiliar to this team, but who have not raced as teammates. Lewis Hamilton, 7-time world champion, and George Russell, who moves across from Williams on a permanent deal this time.
Yeah, a very, very strong lineup. Lewis still smarting from the events of Abu Dhabi last year. Still a great driver. Still a lot to prove. And it's certainly somebody who, you know, if he does a 131 during testing, he can probably do a 129 and a half with exactly the same car during an actual race. He's not a tester. He's a guy who his juices flow about race times. George seems to settle in with the team very well. Obviously, he had that one-off appearance, 18 months ago now in Bahrain, but on the different circuit of Bahrain, where he really was massively unlucky not to win the race. And it's his chance now to cement his place in the top team. I think, you know, I think it's a good place to come in for George. The team's slightly on the back foot, so what they want is a team player, and that's what he'll be. And I don't think they're particularly bothered about who finishes in front of whom for the first two or three races. He's just trying to get the cars home. So he may well be able to avoid either A, looking like he's underperforming, being behind Lewis, or B, causing a political ruptures by finishing in front of him. So I think this is okay for the team. I think they've got a good combination. I think they now have their work cut out. But if, you know, if any team on the grid can pull themselves back forward again, it's Mercedes. But I do genuinely believe they're behind at the moment.
And we move on to the next team, the team that finished second in your last year's Constructors' Championship, and that is Oracle Red Bull Racing. And their car is the RB18, and the engine is the Red Bull RBPTH001.
Really? You mean the Honda?
Do you think that's the... what the H stands for?
I think it is. Now, they have got a small Honda sticker, actually, on the car, haven't they? The back end of the engine cover. Certainly, yeah, the Red Bulls looked okay. It looked okay for the first, but okay to good for the first 5 days of the test, for the testing, the straight down the test. Nice and reliable, got plenty of done. You know, both Sergio and Max seem to be able to get something out of it, which makes you think perhaps the car isn't quite as extreme. And certainly the words are the way you need to drive these cars is much smoother. So Max's very aggressive style probably wouldn't work anyway with these cars. So it may mean that Sergio's a little more in his window of comfort. Looked interesting, looked good. You know, you can see that the new team, because it's not just him anymore, the aero team have done some work. And then, of course, they then brought an upgrade on Friday, the final day of the Bahrain test, actually worked and seemed to improve certainly the slow corner performance of the car. So really, it's been a very, very, very good test period. It seems that they're the quickest. I think they decided to just go for it at the end. I'm not sure I think Max was 3/4 seconds faster than anybody until Mick Schumacher had put in a glory lap at the end. So they really were looking to try and rub it in. Interesting not keeping their power. I think they're trying to make a statement and try and worry teams even more. The thing is, though, and I think it's great to do, but people, because the teams know from their GPS exactly pretty much what everyone else is doing, they'll know that's a genuine 3/4 second or not. But frankly, the team's looking very, very strong and they seem very confident. One thing we don't know of any of these teams. No one can tell us what the situation about tyre wear is. No one can tell us who's got the worst tyre drop or the best tyre drop off, because no one's on a representative race distance against somebody else whilst the cars were set up. So that's something you still know. The Red Bull might be super fast, might burn its tyres out. It might be super fast and be fantastically light on its tyres on these new Pirelli. So there's a lot of variables out there. But if you were, you know, if you were going down the bookmakers and you had your £1 in your pocket, you'd probably put it on Max Verstappen at the moment for the Bahrain Grand Prix.
So reigning world champion Max Verstappen is staying with the team alongside Sergio Perez, certainly for the next 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's Max's team. First of all, can I say congratulations to him for actually using the number one? You are world champion. You should use the number one. This is the most recent world champion to not use number one. Has been particularly irritating. So that's a plus point for Maxi boy. He has been his usual very low-key self. He's not kind of got involved in the hype, but got involved in very much at all, really, actually, since he won the world championship. He's managed to do a couple of sim races, one of which where he absolutely took out the guy in second place and then denied it. So I thought, well, hey, Max, you've not changed. He's just hit the ground running, looking good. Same with Sergio. Sergio's looking a lot closer, but it's, yeah, once we actually get into the action, the thing you can guarantee is that on a Saturday, Max Verstappen is a significantly better qualifier than Sergio Perez. Perez's skill in the race over the last 7 years, really, of his career has really been about tyre preservation. Now, if tyre preservation is still just as important, then Perez is going to still have that massive kind of bonus in the race. But we don't know. These tyres are supposed to be a little bit less susceptible to thermal degradation. They're supposed to be able to lean on them until they kind of actually just wear out. So you're not babying them during the stint. You just have to run them for a stint. They actually get run out of tyre and you just replace them. So you're not having this issue where you can actually overheat them during the stint. So whether Perez's tyre whispering is going to be as valid or perhaps more valid, again, we don't know. No one's done those full distance in a competitive situation. That's something we've yet to find out. But, Perez was much better towards the back end of the season than he was at the start. It's now a car that theoretically should suit him more. You know, he should be a very able number two. It's a strong team. They've got a strong car. the battle, obviously, through all of this will be about the rapid fire upgrades, but they are absolutely poised to make a very strong start to the season.
I think I've worked out what the RBPTH001 is in this engine name. It's Red Bull, previously titled Honda 001.
It's actually Red Bull powertrains, but that's good. That's yours is funny, to be honest.
We shall move on. The team that finished third in the Constructors' Championship last year, 260-something points behind the second-place team, and with half the number of points of the leading team, was Ferrari. And they're another one with an unchanged driver lineup. The Ferrari F175, powered by the Ferrari 0667 engine, has Charles Leclerc and Carlos Sainz Jr. behind the wheel.
Yeah, Ferrari have been the constant high achievers in shakedown and testing. Initially, it was because everyone, the other teams, say, "Well, you had extra, you know, you had extra time due to your extra wind tunnel and CFD runs because you were rubbish in 2021, so 2020. That's why you've managed to get your car into a position where it's so good." And certainly for the first 5 days of the two test procedures, it looks pretty much like the best car, the most balanced car, and it was slightly eclipsed by the Red Bull on the last day. The interesting thing is that Ferrari kind of turned up with the car, and they didn't really bring anything major visible upgrade-wise to the Bahrain test, which kind of means, well, they've obviously got something. They must have learned something. They must have something in the back pocket, because they've got this extra ability to run wind tunnel tests. They've had this car developed for a long time. They've not rushed out any upgrades. So the feeling is that they have a very, very solid platform, which both drivers can exploit very well. It seems to work across a number of different tyre compounds. And they have, of course, the concept. You know, you'd think they would have, they've learned a lot, and they can start chipping off the low-hanging fruit of upgrades. Now, this is actually what Red Bull did with their last day. They managed to find, they identified some weaknesses and found some substantial improvements. And those substantial improvements were available to all the cars. But obviously, it's law of diminishing returns. You find, after the first substantial improvement, you find one that's, perhaps you find a 0.5, then you find a 0.2, then you find a 0.1. After that, you're finding a couple of hundredths each time. So, Ferrari, with their basic Mark 1 concept, have got a great car. You think, hopefully they can develop it. Though, in fairness, that development has not been a massive strong point of the team in the last few years. So, they fell behind Mercedes on a couple of occasions during them when they were trying to compete with them 17 and 18. Not in 19, they were cheating. So, it's a comeback, and it's a good car. And of course, they have two very, very good drivers. You have.
Well, you mentioned the drivers of the front running teams. These are the two drivers who are closest matched, aren't they? They are. This is a team where you don't know on any given weekend who's going to be ahead of the other.
No, because you have the fastest driver with the highest highs is Charles Leclerc, and the more consistent driver with the highest lows, if that makes sense, which is Carlos Sainz. So Sainz runs in an operating window of between, 7.5 and 9.5, whereas Charles Leclerc runs between 7 and 10. So he can drop below Carlos sometimes or go above him sometimes. And it's a strong combination for Ferrari, especially as well as constructors' points ticking up, because one of them's having a slight problem, the other one's normally racking up the points. This is going to be but whilst they've been last year they weren't doing particularly well, so no, I don't think either of them really cared but they didn't care very much who finished ahead of the other. If this car does end up, as we expect, being a championship challenging car, that's when things get awkward and drivers get a little bit more testy about things, and they start, and that's when things start harmonious start breaking down. Carlos Sainz did have a very good relationship with Lando Norris, but he's not really got on with his previous teammates. There's been a lot of friction. The reason he ended up not being in the Red Bull program anymore was because he didn't really get on with Max Verstappen. What the rumor is that his dad didn't get on with Max Verstappen's dad, but with Verstappen being the golden child, there was no room for Carlos. Even though Carlos, in their year together in Toro Rosso, despite a slight points deficit, were actually very similar on race-by-race performance. Just the luck of the points fell just a bit more to Verstappen. Obviously, then he kind of wangled his way out of Red Bull, went to Renault, that didn't really work, and then went to McLaren, where he did a couple of years and moved on again. So he's found a home now, and he's looked very, very accomplished. And I think this is the point about Sainz, is he's a very accomplished driver, and he can rack up the points. But if you look at, but then even you look for the pure genius, and certainly look for the qualifying side of things, you look at Charles Leclerc. And Leclerc, the problem with Leclerc is that on his day, he is as good, easily as good as Max Verstappen, and easily as good as Lewis Hamilton. But currently, his day is not often enough. And what he needs to do is make his day, you know, 19 of the 23 weekends. And then
he needs it to be on a Sunday more often, doesn't he?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think he needs to be on a Sunday, but he needs to be able to run across the weekends. But I mean, he is a very good qualifier. You know, he did win the races with the illegal engine, but, you know, he did actually finish it off in 19. But yeah, I mean, it's a case of really what he needs to do is just get that level of game higher the whole time. That may well be, once you give someone like Charles Leclerc a championship winning car, that just comes naturally. You know, suddenly the motivation is there and you're just driving and pushing forward. And you know, perhaps sometimes when the car showed up at some of the races last year, it wasn't particularly competitive. You kind of went, I'll have a quiet one. Because, you know, that's the way that the mentality works as a sportsman. But that's what he needs to do. Whereas science kind of always shows up at this very high level. So it's going to be really down to how good the car is and how good Charles's brain is.
Let's move on to last year's fourth place constructor, and that is the McLaren F1 team. This year they have the MCL36, and again it's powered by the Mercedes AMG F1 M13 engine.
Very popular engine. Yeah, so it's absolutely a tale of two tests, or a tale of a shakedown and a test. Very, very good shakedown in Barcelona. They managed to get a lot of miles done, looked very quick. Both drivers got to run, and then they come to Bahrain and things start unraveling. The main one, well, one of the bigger ones being that Daniel Ricciardo was ill. Eventually, that was COVID, so he couldn't run at all in those 3 days. And theoretically, he should be just about free for the start of the season in Bahrain. By just about, I mean, like in the morning of the first qualifying practice. Which left Lando Norris to do all 3 days. And normally that would be, with 100, 110 laps they want to do each day, that would be normally a massive ask. But as it turns out, because of a difficult-to-fathom brake problem, and the front brakes with constant overheating, they never really got to do any particularly long runs. So they just performed some performance runs and some balance runs and some setup runs. But they couldn't do long runs because the brakes just wouldn't work. And it's a strange situation to find, because you think they had no issue in Barcelona, but obviously Barcelona was ambient was probably 18 or 19, perhaps more than that, but it's 20 degrees lower. So they've made some errors in their front brake design, the front brake air distribution, which they can fix. That's not an issue, but they've lost that time now. And in doing that, they kind of lost impetus, a couple of decent runs towards the end of Saturday for them. But the net effect really was they just didn't have a second test they want to write home about. And now they go into Bahrain. They're going to have Daniel, if he's better, with very little experience of the car and no experience on the track, unlike every other driver who's done, you know, hundreds of laps around here. So he's on the back foot. Norris has done the laps, but the car wasn't right and wasn't the same as it was, so he's on the back foot. So it's not the way to start the season. They're on the back foot. But on the flip side, the basic car seems relatively okay, so it's not the end of the world. But you know, it's interesting how, you know, things can unravel reasonably quickly. Now they obviously have upgrades to bring as well. They have things to work on the car, but you know they are looking, you know, at the moment, you know, equal third or fourth with Mercedes, and you just kind of know Mercedes will kick on from their issues. Can McLaren kick on from their issues to bridge that gap to the top two teams? And that's a question, and it's a key year. I mean, Lando Norris obviously just signed a long-term contract. Lando does look the real thing. I mean, Danny Ric is, you know, coming off a bad year and needs to reassert himself in the top level of races. And they've now got testing Colton Herta. There's kind of a background feeling that, you know, even though Danny Ric theoretically has a contract for next year as well, if things don't go well, they may well replace him, which is something you wouldn't have thought of a year ago. That's how quickly things change in F1, and his luck has not started particularly well. But so when the car does hit the ground, it's kind of looking like it's fighting for, you know, lower end of the top 10, because the problem is with the massive reliability of these machines these days, you could see there being two Red Bulls and two Ferraris in the top four positions.
Obviously, when Daniel Ricciardo first went to McLaren, that was at a point where Lando had been there a year, so there was always going to be 2 years, was it? So he was always going to have been needing some time to settle in, but he really needs to start winning races this year, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think people underestimated Lando, because Lando is so underestimating of himself. I mean, he said he has confidence problems, and he doesn't. He presents himself as his bouncy little kid who's very keen to be there. And you don't understand the steel of the driver underneath that. He has ended up comprehensively kicking on last season and beating Ricciardo, not just because he was getting used to it, but the whole way through. You know, with interesting, the only really exception was in Monza when they actually won the race. So Danny's got a battle on his hands, and I think he found himself hard to come back at Lando in a car that Lando knew better, as you rightly said. To been there a couple of years beforehand, these cars are always, certainly at this point, evolutions of what went before. Now, if we have a revolution, it's a clean sheet of paper, and everything was going really well. But suddenly, Lando's got three more days in the car. Lando now has 4.5 days against 1.5 days, and has risen the track. So the chance of Danny beating him this weekend is basically zero outside of reliability. So he then has to kind of mentally go, right, fine, this is what's happened this week. And they've only got another week to Saudi. And that's assuming that even if he tests negative, Danny has shaken off COVID and doesn't have any ill effects. You know, we saw that Lewis was affected by it a little bit, I think, in the first half of last season. It can affect people in a nasty way, it can affect people in a relatively lightweight way, you know. So hopefully he can get going. But yeah, he is going to start on a heavy back foot in a season where he needs to massively impress. The only advantage is with 22 or 23 races in the season, you've now got plenty of chances to do it.
Yes, and that's assuming, of course, that he does test negative on Friday morning and is allowed to take part this weekend.
Oh, more stories than that, I'm sure, during the week, absolutely.
Yeah, more on that on Midget Motorsport if you're listening to this on Monday night as we do it live and not on the podcast after you've already listened to Wednesday's Midweek Motorsport. That's confusing, isn't it?
Confused me.
And me. The team that finished fifth last year with 155 points was Alpine. And this year they have got a car called the A522, which runs through Staffordshire. It's powered by the Renault E-Tech RE22, and it's another brand team new that has no changes of driver, because they're sticking with Fernando Alonso and Esteban Ocon.
Yeah, I think Alpine, obviously the big news about it was two big, well, I don't know, just stop myself. There's three big news about Alpine: new engine, new team principal, and the hottest prospect is just their reserve driver. So they've the brand new engine, which they didn't rush forward like Honda did for last season, which is now a split turbo device and is designed to finally bridge that final bit of gap to Mercedes and the rest. An engine which they were worried about reliability for, but seems to have run faultlessly throughout both tests. So admittedly, it was run on quite low rate, low power levels in Barcelona, and more importantly, other problems in Barcelona where they didn't use DRS. They looked a little bit out of sorts. Of they managed to get the miles in, but didn't really put in much of a time. In Bahrain, they were quite under the radar, really, which is odd when you've got a bright pink car.
Pink on one day, though.
Yes, I know, because this is the weird thing. They're going to have the full Magnesium Water Company livery on the first two races, which is the bright pink, basically looking like a Force India from 3 years ago. And then they're going to go back to kind of a majority blue with pink elements for the rest of the season. So it's a problem, really, when you are a bright pink sponsor and you're sponsoring works teams. They want to run with their works colours as well. So they've kind of come to a compromise, which I'm sure was involved a number of dollars going each way.
Why don't teams have a different livery every weekend?
Well, oddly, I don't think it's allowed. I'm not quite sure what the rules are. I think kind of different livery in different cars, as Craig Pollock found out all those years ago. But I think it's difficult to comment. I mean, Fernando was making some very warm noises about the car, which is good, because obviously Fernando's very vocal about whether things are good or bad. Esteban Ocon, I didn't really think I heard anything from him really in the whole of the test, actually. I mean, I'm sure he was being quoted by people. Nothing picked up. The car seemed reliable, which was the key point. It just didn't seem particularly outstandingly fast. But that, again, we are stuck in this morass of a lack of knowledge of what people were running, what fuel loads, what, you know, how they were attacking it, what engine modes. I think it's safe to say that Alpine are around the middle of the field. And again, they have the ability to move up with the correct developments, which might be more likely to happen with Otmar in the team principal roles rather than the previous incumbent. But, you know, he's not been there long enough to make a big impression or a big influence, on how they go about their business. So it's one of those ones where it's really, really interesting where they turn up, because they could turn up and they could have really done a fantastic job and suddenly Alonso's qualified fifth and Ocon seventh. Or they could be 14th and 15th just as easily. There's quite a lot of those sort of teams towards this middle pack. You can't really work out, because they're just doing these programs, and occasionally they stick in a super quick lap. It might be on a softer tire, but you never knew how much fuel was in the car. And the weight is so important to lap time. Someone that literally ran it on fumes, I think Haas may have done that. You can put a fantastic time in, but it doesn't mean anything, because, you know, you're faster by half a second. The car that's got 50 kilograms of fuel on it actually means you're a second slower. And that's a problem of testing. Even when you've got multiple coverage of it, you still don't know what people are doing. There's no weigh bridge on the way out, and there's no power mode indicator in the top left-hand corner of the screen.
I've been digging through Alpine's press releases of the last week, and I found a quote from Esteban Ocon. This was from Friday.
Good.
He said,
right,
"Today was our best day of pre-season testing so far, with very good progress made and good understanding gained on the A522. We ran through a busy programme, pretty much to plan, which is very important at this stage of the test. It's been solid, and I'm happy with the work completed today. The next time I'll be in the car will be next Friday for the first free practice session of the season. That's when it really counts, so I'm looking forward to doing it all for real."
And do you believe he wrote any of those words, or said any of those words? No.
He may have done.
I'm not having a go at Esteban whatsoever. I think he's a lovely bloke, but my feeling is that was pretty much just rattled off by the PR people.
I think he may have said some of these words, though.
Go on.
J'ai bénéficié d'une demi-journée au volant et nous avons presque réussi à parcourir une distance de course pendant ce laps de temps, which means he's done a full race distance during the test.
Oh, right. That's new information in French.
Yes. He didn't say that in English, did he?
Right, because the English, because it probably was the French quote was actually a quote.
C'était bien de découvrir la nouvelle monoplace à Bahrein, un circuit très différent de Barcelone, avec des conditions complètement contrastées. So it's really good to learn about the new car in Bahrain, which is a circuit very different from Barcelona, and in conditions which are completely different as well. We will concentrate today, or we were concentrating today on beginning to understand the degradation and performance of these tyres.
Excellent. Nothing of which appeared in the English translation.
None of which appeared in the English translation.
Or the English press release written by Beryl in accounting.
Anything else to say about Alpine?
No.
Well, in that case, we need to move on to another team, beginning with A, and that is AlphaTauri, or
yes,
as we call them, Scuderia AlphaTauri, who are using the AT03 chassis and the Red Bull RBPTH001 engine for another unchanged driver lineup of Pierre Gasly and Yuki Tsunoda.
Yeah, the car has a lot of Red Bull parts in it, as it's allowed to do. They have, in previous years, kind of eased back on that, often used the previous year's rear suspension, but they had the whole rear end engine powertrain from Red Bull, so Honda and the gearbox, and that's all. Whereas, of course, it is a completely independent design car, attractive. I think it looks nice. It's a nice livery. They seem to have a handle on it in Barcelona, but they didn't really seem to kick on at all in Bahrain. Whether they just weren't interested in doing performance testing, or really whether they just didn't have any, you know, when they got there, they were looking at the change in the temperature, they found, well, this isn't quite working. The car, which did look pretty good, actually, in fairness, in Barcelona, just looked very average. Just didn't, you know. The good news is that Yuki Tsunoda looked as good as Gasly, because we have to remember that Bahrain is his specialist circuit. That was where he was absolutely brilliant last year as well. So, you know, if anyone's going to flatter a car, or flatter himself, it's Yuki Tsunoda at Bahrain. But I thought that the car going round, it just looked okay. You know, it didn't seem to have any bite. It didn't seem particularly quick. Don't know whether they were on power modes, don't know whether they were on weight. Pretty. Gasly, we know, is a very competent racing driver who needs to make a career decision. Is he going to continue his life just being the bloke who's the faster of the two at AlphaTauri? Is he going to try and get another job at the end of the year? You know, I think he would be in demand. He's had two good years, perhaps slightly better in 2020 when he won the race in Monza. Not because he won the race, he just, I think, he was really pushing on. And last year, a couple of times, when he just looked a bit average, but that could have been the car. So Gasly needs to shine. Snow needs to do well to avoid losing his seat. But in fairness to him, he was getting better towards the back end of last season. And having done all the tracks, basically, obviously apart from the new ones, I think that will benefit him as well. He did look better at tracks he knew. So he needs to really up his level across the whole season. I think he's possible to do, because he's very young as well. I think he's still in 21 now. So Tsunoda could actually begin to live up to his promise at the very, very beginning of last year. I'd like to see him do it. And Gasly needs to push on. So driver-wise, last year, I think Gasly scored like 80% of their points, or even more, because Tsunoda really just faded away. So team-wise, they got a good pair of drivers. Car looks ordinary. Now, doesn't mean they can't sort it out. Doesn't mean it can't suddenly be a car that's going to attack the bottom end of the points. But it just didn't, apart from being quite attractive, it didn't really catch the eye at all, Tim.
How long, really, does Tsunoda have? Because we know that Red Bull don't hang on to drivers who are underperforming. And there's no doubt that he underperformed last year. Probably because he came into Formula One a year earlier than he needed to.
I agree entirely. I think he should have had another year in F2.
He's not going to last the full season unless he starts doing a lot better.
No, I think he will. I don't think they've really got anybody to kick him out with half of the season. The obvious one is actually at Williams, which is bringing Alex back in again. Beyond that, I'd need to consult you as our expert in lower level single seater, but who's got enough Super League points to even get in?
Super license points, you mean?
I meant to say Super League, as it's a pun on previous failed single seater championships. Who's got enough license points? And I'm not sure anybody has. So they will almost certainly stick with Tsunoda the whole way through the season, but hopefully there won't be a reason to worry about that.
Okay, so we move on to Aston Martin, which is Aston Martin Aramco Cognizant F1 team. The AMR...
It's not Aramco Aston Martin. Is it Aston Martin Aramco, is it?
Aston Martin Aramco, yes.
Right.
Cognizant F1 team. The AMR 22, and again, they have the AMG F1 M13 engine, and again, they have an unchanged driver lineup. One day I'll learn how to say driver lineup without saying Driner. Sebastian Vettel and Lance Stroll.
Yes, so daddy's boy and the ex-world champion. The car seems, again, in that okay field. I mean, its ultimate lap time's not great, but the team seems quite positive and probably wasn't going for ultimate lap times. They had a relatively trouble-free run, lost half a day at the back end of the Barcelona test, a couple of niggles during the Bahrain test, but they got plenty of laps in. Lance had a couple of, I can't remember if it was day one or day two of the second test, whether he was, but yeah, he was flirting at the top of the timesheets as well with a couple of quicker soft tyre runs. car didn't look, you know, interesting. It didn't look awful. Didn't look great on the track. And I think the car will be competent. Obviously, last year's was blighted by the fact that it was a knockoff Mercedes from the year before, and they didn't know how to adjust the knockoff Mercedes to make account of the rule changes. Whereas the people who actually designed the car, Mercedes, made a much better fist of it. They obviously have Mike Crackham from BMW. They've lost Snaff now, so that's a change at the top, and it will at least mean that. I'm sure Mike will be much more on message with what Lawrence Stroll wants to say, but that's actually what any of us want to hear is another question entirely. But, you know, it's the question, the problem they have there is they are a full works team now who is spending full works money, and they are building wind tunnels, they're building facilities. But they have two drivers who both have massive question marks over them. Sebastian Vettel is a four-time world champion, but he has been on the wane probably since he won his fourth championship, but definitely since his second, since 2017. His performances in 18, 19 have not been great. He can still produce it. You know, that concept that form is temporary and class is permanent, it does come to the fore every now and again. I remember Turkey in 2020, the Ferrari, obviously, when he had the chance to win in Hungary, almost got there, even though he would have been ultimately disqualified. So there's still that element there within the Vettel, and you kind of feel that if only he could slap himself around the face a couple of times a morning, he could bring that out far more regularly. You know, the talent is still there, it just seems depressed sometimes. Lance Stroll is kind of a weird situation because he's a son of a billionaire, he's an F3 champion, and kind of deserves to be in F1, but also kind of irritates you he's in F1 because he's the son of a billionaire who owns the team. He just needs to do more. You know, he's a very good driver, and this is the thing: he's brilliant in the wet, which is the ultimate test. I mean, I think he has a number of confidence problems. I think he gets his head's not perhaps where it should be. But the problem is, what is the stick? You know, we know what the carrot is. I wonder where is the stick? Because if you know you're not going to get fired because your daddy owns a team. Where's the stick? Where's the frightener? Where's the thing that keeps you going? Where's the thing that gets you up at night thinking how I can go quicker? And that's why I think he misses. I think he needs that. He needs that kind of chance he's going to get fired to perhaps make him a little bit more robust over the weekend and knowing he needs to do it. And Vettel needs to rediscover his magic of, if he can't discover the magic of 2030, at least discover the magic of 2016.
Okay, let's move on to Williams Racing, the FW44, the Mercedes-AMG F1 M13 engine. Nicholas Latifi stays with the team. Alexander Albon joins the team.
Yeah, I think the Williams obviously had the most spectacular problem in Bahrain, where the rear brakes caught fire due to apparently a basic finger trouble error in the pit. And then it set fire, the whole rear end, it collapsed and something exploded, probably a tire or an element of the car. It looked very spectacular. But the issue is, I think of all the teams, the only one that really looked to be a little bit off the pace was Williams. They never really put in a super fast lap. Both drivers were quite close in time. Nicholas Latifi obviously knows the team and the car very well. Alex Albon, you know, he has a lot of talent. And hopefully his confidence has been built back up again after a very bruising season in a bit at Red Bull, but the car doesn't look quick. Now, again, it's very hard to say, you know, visually, is that something they can sort out? Is it suspension? Because you don't get the same massive lappery and the massive analysis of the Williams as you will with the top few teams. So you don't get a chance to see where the problems are. It's just not looking fast, or it's just not being fast is the issue. The team itself is very bullish. So, you know, perhaps they are just holding everything in reserve. But my money wouldn't be on them, you know, climbing out of that. Well, if it is the same team. If there was a bottom three, my money wouldn't be on them climbing out of it, Tim. There might not be a bottom three. It might be a bottom one. But they did seem, on paper, I'd say they looked the team that was the least quick. But they don't think they're in trouble.
Well, they certainly were bottom three last year. So it's just a question of how bad the other two from that bottom three are. We'll move on to the one that was worst of all a little bit later. But let's talk about Alfa Romeo F1 team Orlen. with the Alfa Romeo Sauber C42 and the Ferrari 0667 engine. Complete driver change here. They brought in Valtteri Bottas, who joined them from Mercedes, and Guanyu Zhou, who joined them from Formula 2.
Yeah, and joins them with a big with a big check, but that's fine. Yeah, I mean, I think the Alfa Romeo, obviously the story of the Alfa Romeo was they had a terrible test in Barcelona where the porpoising effectively destroyed the undertray of the car. So they couldn't really run the car, and they didn't very much. And they had some more niggly stuff through the Bahrain test, but they did actually manage to put in a couple of quick laps, which could have been glory laps. But they did seem to be a little bit, certainly better off than Williams, apart from the loss of mileage. But they, if they've got their setup work done and they kind of understand the car and they've got the week to work on it, that should be fine. Valtteri Bottas seemed quite pleased with the machine. I mean, he should know. He seemed quite happy with it. And Guanyu Zhou did lots of laps, what he needs to do. But my question mark really about the team anyway is they've hired Valtteri, and Valtteri's a great qualifier. So, you know, if the car's a midfield car and he qualifies the car in 10th, that's great. The only problem is Valtteri's not a very good wheel-to-wheel racer. So you kind of can't see him going forward in the race. You only see him going backwards. You can't be a scrapper once you get down the back of the field. It's fine being Valtteri Bottas, you're going to start on the front two rows. But you're going to start on row 5, 6, or 7. Is he the sort of person you see, you know, sweeping past four cars in the first corner? No. And that's, I believe, the problem that Alfa Romeo have is they've got a driver who's probably going to get the car, who's going to do a Jarno Trulli and get the car into a place it shouldn't be and then just drift back. And that's not how you score points at the back of the field. Guanyu Zhou's on a learning curve. You know, if you're going to pick drivers to pluck out of Formula 2, he wouldn't have been at the top of anybody's list for a race seat. However, he's not bad. He's won races. He's been there or thereabouts. Three seasons he's done in F2. Tim, I think he is. And he's got into the team on nationality and cash base. And, you know, that's not meant to be a side because people have got into nationality and cash base into F1 on a number of occasions. The weird thing is, of course, there actually isn't, as we point out, there isn't a Chinese Grand Prix this year, but he'll desperately hope he can do well enough this year to stay on for another year. So there is a Chinese Grand Prix. So, yeah, I mean, I think Alfa Romeo are looking in a significantly better situation than they did last year. The car seems good. And they've got an interesting combination of drivers, which is at least a match for Kimi Raikkonen when he was, however, 42, and Antonio Giovinazzi. The thing that they're going to have to work on is, of course, they managed to snatch defeat from the jaws of, if not victory, at least point scores so often last year. Their operational efficiency was way below where you expect the Swiss race team to be. In fact, it was the antithesis of Swiss. So whichever it is, name your country you think is the least organised that you know, and that's what they were, rather than the Swiss efficiency. They just literally made so many errors in the race and cost themselves points. So they need to eliminate that, and then they need to see if they can find a way of getting the car to start as high as possible so Valtteri's drift back doesn't drift out of the points.
Zhou, of course, has been a Formula 1 test driver for 2 years as well, but not with this team, but with Alpine instead.
Yeah, so he got a couple of sessions and a couple of rookie sessions. Because the problem with that is that's all in the cars of the previous generation. These things are so different that what is the carryover apart from learning the track? The actual car carryover is very little. It might be something, of course, like the complexity of engine management and engine deployment and, you know, on the fly brake balance adjustments. But beyond that, it's a start from zero for Guanyu.
So that brings us on to our final team, and that is Haas. The Haas F1 team has the VF22 chassis and the Ferrari 0667 engine. They retain Mick Schumacher and put him up against Kevin Magnussen, who is a short-notice replacement.
Yeah, I mean, it's very rare that the team that finished solidly last in a world championship has monopolized the headlines for a week, though everything to do with off-track activities. In fact, even off the entirety of motorsport, because obviously politics came into and geopolitics came into it, and there was no way that they could keep their sponsor, and no way they could keep their previous driver. So with Mazepin being out, a replacement was sought, and everyone who was in the know, said it's going to be X, Y, and Z, and then they all got it wrong because it's Kevin Magnussen. The reason people thought it wasn't going to be Kevin Magnussen, Kevin Magnussen had two very lucrative series drives already signed up this year for Chip Ganassi and Peugeot, but the call of Formula One was too much. And
I remember Kevin came back. Peugeot isn't actually going to race, so you know, it's not a real job.
Was cash, though. And yeah, it turns out Gunter Steiner says that he was the only person he ever spoke to, and I've no reason to disbelieve Gunter. And everyone seemed genuinely pleased to have it back. I think it's a matter of fact now that Drive to Survive has come out, that Mazepin and his father, regardless of what you think about them, their nationality and their passports, were actually a corrosive pair on the team. And that sat morale based with the fact you've got a team that knew it was going to do nothing all year because they weren't developing an already poor car. You know, they come back and they get plunged into a geopolitical crisis. They come out of that. They then sign up a very popular driver they all know. So it absolutely circumnavigates the learning curve. Everyone knows who he is. And they get another great thing, which they get a benchmark for Mick Schumacher. Mick must be pleased to have someone who's got some experience, someone who's medium fast, not blisteringly fast, but still pretty good. So Mick knows if he can beat Kevin, it's going to be a feather in his cap. So it works well as an incentive for Schumacher. It works, obviously, no one's more incentivized than the Magnus to prove him wrong for the second time he's been blocked for a year in his career. So the driver lineup really has gone from being quite, probably the worst driver lineup to being a really strong lineup because by employing Magnussen, you've effectively improved Schumacher as well, if that makes sense. I think you'll see a better Schumacher and more focused Schumacher because he's got something to aim at and he isn't just going to end up a minute ahead in the race because Mazepin's rubbish. The car seems fine. It had longer to develop than anybody else, had more wind tunnel time than anybody else, and they've developed a very neat piece of kit. They've done a couple of glory rounds during the week. Magnussen managed to be the fastest on the first day running, or the second day running a bit later than everyone else because they had some extra time after losing time with freight delays. And the track does get quicker as it gets cooler. So he did that. And I think Mick also on their extra running on the Saturday managed to come in second fastest overall just by Verstappen. No one's saying it's the second fastest car, but the car's got pace. And you think that is not going to be rooted at the bottom. You think, there's a possibility it could even reach into the midfield. If we say there's three or four teams buzzing around the top, and then there's three or four teams buzzing around the middle, it may be that Haas are in that middle group, which would be great to see. But again, until they hit the ground on Saturday afternoon for qualifying, all bets are off because there's not. Also, remember that we had previous knowledge of the cars from 2014 onwards. Yeah, it's all different now. Even the tyres are different. Everything's different. No, anyone who says they know the order of the team or the drivers when they line up on Sunday afternoon or finish the race is a liar because you can't know. There's too many variables. Everything is a variable.
Well, I'm not going to ask you to predict the order in which the teams line up on Sunday. I'm going to ask you to predict the order of the teams at the end of the season, Nick.
Oh, dear. Okay.
You can go from front to back or back to front, whichever way you want.
I will go front to back. I think it's going to be... This is quite... Am I allowed to revise it after one race?
No.
Right, I think so. Teams championships.
Yes,
I'm going to go Ferrari.
Yeah,
Mercedes, mm-hmm. Red Bull, McLaren, Alpine, and
it's halfway.
Then, Aston Martin. I'll put Haas in next. AlphaTauri. Who have we got left?
You've got Williams, you haven't had Alfa Romeo,
Williams, and then Alfa Romeo, Williams.
Okay, so...
But I think, by the way, I think Verstappen's been world champion, though.
Okay. I'll write that down. We can come back to that in late November.
I just think it's going to end up being really close, and I think the driver combinations are better in Mercedes and... Ferrari than they are in Red Bull. And I think Red Bull will focus everything behind Verstappen, which will be enough for him to win the World Championship. But they will, much as they did this year, they'll just drop behind other teams in the team championship because they don't care about it.
And you think Guan Yu Zhou will be the rookie of the year?
He's the only one now, isn't he?
He is.
Yeah, well, we'll give it to him then, shall we?
Might as well give him the trophy now. Although, you never know.
Someone might come in.
We'll see Yuki Tsunoda get dropped halfway through the season, or everyone realise that Kevin Magnussen is way faster than Mick Schumacher. And
Danny Rick may even not take the first race, in which case we might see Oscar Piastri for a race.
Wouldn't that be embarrassing? Guan Yu Zhou does a full season and is beaten to Rookie of the Year by Oscar Piastri, who does a single race.
I think that's unlikely.
I think that's unlikely as well. I think that Alfa Romeo has the potential to score some points this year.
So do I.
Well, Nick's not the only person we've asked to rank the teams because earlier in the week or over the weekend, I asked Alex Brundle, who's out in Sebring at the moment, getting ready for this week's WEC season opener. But he'll be working for F1 TV for the bulk of this season, so many of you will hear him commentating on the races. And we've asked him for his predictions, and he has also put Red Bull at the top, Ferrari is second, then McLaren, Mercedes and AlphaTauri. Haas in 6th, Alpine 7th, Aston Martin 8th, Alfa Romeo 9th, and he agrees with you, Nick, with Williams in 10th position. Nick, thank you very much for your contribution over the last 75 minutes.
Thank you. It's good fun, as always. I wish I knew more. I'm sure in every other preview we've done, I'd be more definite about stuff. But honestly, we just don't know.
And if we want to find out, well, tune in to Motorsport Motorsport every Wednesday on RS1 for Nick Damon's insight into Formula 1 and, of course, the return of the team-by-team guide to all 23 or 22 races this season.
It'll be 23. But obviously World War 3.
And for now, from Nick and from myself, good night.
This program is a Radio Show Limited production.
Tell your friends there's more at RadioLeMans.com.